Hello, and thank you for joining us for How Have You Not Seen, a movie podcast where we fill in the gaps in each other's cinematic knowledge by asking important questions like, you really never saw The Phantom of the Opera, or
you never caught Hard Candy, or
how have you not seen Lost in Translation? Hello again, and thank you for joining us for How Have You Not Seen. I am your co-host, Caroline Thompson.
I'm Carson Betts.
And this is How Have You Not Seen, a movie podcast where each week we pick one of our favorite movies that the other hasn't seen.
We talk about it.
Then we go and watch the movie.
And we talk about it some more.
It's going to be a pretty good time. It's kind of like a melancholic time, but not, you know. Yeah. I think this is a good time at the movies. Personally.
This is a weepy one, right? This one's kind of weepy, yeah?
It's more a little like, you know, I'd say it's more a little, it's a little more ennui than weepy, you know, a little more
sure.
Like beleaguered sigh about it all than it sure. Necessarily is like time to weep. But yeah, a little lost, one might say. So Carson,
yes.
Well, that is what we will find out. How have you not seen Lost in Translation?
That is an extremely good question. I don't know that I have a great story for this one. It's probably a movie that I should have watched by now. It's obviously one of those big ones. It's big letterboxed movie, big kind of film account on Instagram posting pretty screenshots from movie. Yeah, I don't know. I really should have by now. I just never got around to it.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Well, if that's your answer, what do you know about Lost in Translation?
Directed, I think, and written by? ? I'm not sure. Sofia Coppola.
I believe that's right.
This is post Virgin Suicides, pre Marie Antoinette. Yes,
that is
like late '90s or like 2001. This movie came out.
2003.
Okay.
Yeah. So it is written and directed by Sofia Coppola, and your timeline of things is right. But let me make sure there's like nothing in between them. Yeah. Virgin Suicides in '99, Lost in Translation 2003, Marie Antoinette sure. 2006.
Okay, so this movie is about Bill Murray is an actor, right? He's like a struggling actor, obviously an older man, the age of Bill Murray in 2002 mm-hmm. when they shot the movie. He has gone to Japan to like shoot a commercial or something, like he's there for work. Scarlett Johansson, obviously a much younger woman in her early 20s, is in Japan like on a university trip, right? Some such. She's there for some reason. They're both in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And point being, they both, you know, by some circumstances, they meet each other. They're both two very deeply lonely people in two very different situations. They are, you know, two of the only Americans where they're at. So they can speak to each other. They both know English. And they just get talking. And it's about them spending time together in Tokyo. I think the nature of their relationship, as I have read it from the outside, that it is not explicitly sexual romantic, though there is like the open question as to whether or not that might be a thing. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And it's like I would say it's less of like a, oh, there's an open question of, is it romantic? And more of like, it is a very like intimate relationship that like people kind of can't help but like feel has some romantic tension there, even though it's really more, it certainly is not that in any explicit kind of way.
Sure.
Yeah.
And they form this like unlikely friendship, and then they have to leave each other at the end of the film. And I know that there's, you know, kind of the meme is the movie ends with Bill Murray whispers something to Scarlett Johansson, but you never know what he said. And that is like the final moment
mm-hmm.
in the film.
Yes.
I believe that's everything I know.
Honestly, like it is a very kind of like, it is a very, you know, it's a, it is very much a movie about a vibe. It's very much a movie about like a feeling. It's not a super plot heavy movie. So yeah, you kind of knocks it out of the park with that.
I'm really good at this. I've been doing this podcast for a little while now.
Uh-huh. You sure have.
I have approximate knowledge of many movies. That's the correct thing about me.
That's literally the whole thrust of this program. That's absolutely right. It's very funny. I'm glad you bring up From Square One. Like, you don't know what he says. And we've talked about this many times on the podcast that the ambiguity is the point. If they wanted you to know, they would tell you or show you. Yeah, it is very funny because there are all these people who are convinced they know what he actually says when the full point is. Anyway, I digress. Yeah. With that being said, is there anything else you know about the film, or are you ready to get into our little game?
I'm ready for the game, girl. Let's play. Let's
perfect. Do it. Well, in that case, we are going to play a favorite on the show. We are going to be playing the Rotten Tomatoes Price is Right. Or Rotten Tomatoes, The Price is Right, rather. Not The Rotten Tomatoes Price is Right. Same thing. You get it. You understand. And so the way this game works is I have selected three films, and Carson and I are going to try to guess the tomato meter score on RottenTomatoes.com. Closest without going over wins best 2 out of 3. All right, Carson, as always, the film we are talking about first is the film that we are covering in this episode, which is Lost in Translation.
I mean, this movie is extremely highly regarded. I've never heard someone talk about this movie in a way that was not positive. I don't think that it's one of those like famous, you know, 99% on Rotten Tomatoes, totally 5 stars in Letterboxd movies. Sofia Coppola's movies do tend to sell vibes and feelings more than they do plot and character. So I can imagine if you're just not on that wavelength, then you just won't be on the wavelength of the movie. So I'm going to be kind of safe so that I don't accidentally go over. I'm going to say 92, which I think might be a little low.
I think that's a pretty incredible guess, Carson.
I'm going to say 92. Thank you.
I think that's really, really safe.
Thank you.
I think 92 is a really stellar guess. I think it's really solid. And so if I had to put my chips on, if it is, like, I'm sure it's in the 90s. So if I'm going to put my chips down on, do I think you went over, or do I think you're slightly under? I think you're really right on the money. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go down just a little bit. You said 92. I'm going to say 89 just to give myself a little bit of wiggle room. But I think you probably, if you didn't get that right on the nugget, I think it's probably like 93 or 4.
Yeah.
The next film we are going to talk about is a film from just a few years earlier. It's 1998's Lost in Space. Have you ever seen this film?
I know. I've heard it's really weird.
I have not seen it since I was a child, but for some reason it was one of the VHS tapes that my family owned. Mm. And it was one of the non-Disney VHS tapes that we owned. So I have seen this movie probably 20 times all before the age of 9.
Yeah. A lot of movies like that. I've talked about this in the podcast. I think I've seen Night at the Museum like 17 times.
Yep.
Probably. Maybe more than any other movie. Lost in Space, not well remembered or regarded, was a post or like mid Friends Matthew Perry vehicle.
LeBlanc, Matt LeBlanc.
Oh, okay. RIP. Unfortunate. But yeah, nobody remembers that movie.
No. LeBlanc is still alive.
Which one's dead? Oh, Perry's dead.
Perry's the one who passed away.
Oh.
Matt LeBlanc is still alive.
I don't like Friends. And weirdly, none of those people really had a career in movies after
correct.
Friends, which is kind of odd. Except for Aniston and kind of Kudrow.
Oh yeah, Aniston has had a very robust career outside of Friends.
Yeah,
so
but nothing.
She's
like
the one. And Courtney Cox has done okay. I mean, really, just the Scream franchise,
TV, though.
In terms of films.
TV,
but,
yeah, TV. I'm talking about movies. Like Kudrow's been in a lot of movies, but also like few. All of them, I think, have been in fewer movies than you would think, based upon the success of that show. Point being, Lost in Space. I'm gonna say 40. 40 exactly.
40.
40.
Okay.
I think it's rotten.
I do too. I think, my lord. I think, if anything, I think you busted. So I'm going to say 25 for Lost in Space, because I do not remember much of this film, and knowing the cast that this film had. So for example, William Hurt and Gary Oldman are both in it.
Oh, damn. Okay.
And it's never brought up in any of their like career retrospectives. It's never like, oh yes. And then William Hurt famously, and or like, you know, it's never like Gary Oldman, you know, like great turn in Leon the Professional. And then before going on to Jim Gordon was great as the villain in, yeah, you know, in Lost in Space. And then the other people, you've got Heather Graham, which no shade on her name, but not a particularly amazing actor, and Matt LeBlanc. And it's kind of one of those movies that it's like, oh, well, it's got Heather Graham and Matt LeBlanc in it. Like, mm-hmm. It's kind of one of those movies. It's kind of the reputation I feel like this has. So, okay, great. So you said 40, I said 25. The third film we are going to talk about is Lost in Translation star Bill Murray's direct follow-up to Lost in Translation, which is Garfield.
Oh, that's what he did?
In which he voices Garfield.
Ah, yes, the titular lazy fat cat that loves Mondays, everyone's favorite. Or loves Mondays, hates Mondays. He hates Mondays. He loves
hates
lasagna.
Hates Mondays, loves lasagna.
Loves lasagna, just like me, am I right?
Not particularly care for that Odie, you know?
Normal? Oh, don't even get him started on Normal.
What is Nermal? I don't even know what that means.
You don't know Nermal? Nermal's the little cat. I don't know. I'm afraid I'm going to misgender Nermal. I don't know if Nermal's a boy or a girl. Nermal's like a little cat that's like pink and really annoying, and Garfield doesn't like Nermal.
Huh.
I'm going to text you a picture of Nermal. Okay. Garfield, the live action with animated characters, Garfield. It had a sequel. It made money, obviously. It's like a dumb kids movie.
Yeah.
But nobody liked it. 55? 55.
Okay, 55. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say 55. I'm going to go up ever so slightly. I'm going to say 58. I was too gracious in giving you, in going below you on Lost in Translation. So I'm going to cut it kind of close and say 58 for Garfield.
I'm sorry. I looked up Nermal. Can I tell you some stuff about Nermal real quick?
Please be so fast, because we are now done with the game.
It's going to be so fast, I swear to God, and then we'll go to the break. So I looked up Nermal. That's Nermal right there. Little cat. Nermal. A boy. I also find out. Personality. On the Garfield wiki page, there's a thing that's just personality. Nermal's personality is naive, annoying, narcissistic, nice, smart aleck, arrogant, devious, smug, mischievous, selfish, obnoxious, adorable, innocent, cute, diabolical, at times cocky, full of himself, self-loving, somewhat antagonistic, sweet, vain, pampered, effeminate, mean, feminine, and adorable.
Huh.
That is so many words to describe the same five personality traits. And also, wow, they really put Nermal in the ground on the Garfield wiki.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dang, Nermal.
I did not know that Nermal was a character, and Godspeed, Nermal. All right. That having been said, Carson, are you ready to go watch Lost in Translation?
I'm so ready.
All right, well, we'll see you after the break once we've watched the film. Hi, everyone. This is Caroline with How Have You Not Seen? Normally, this is where we would put an ad break, and we are going to direct you all, starting in with our 2024 season, for the remainder of the season, and hopefully not much longer after that, but who knows, we are going to ask that in lieu of following one of our sponsor links, which we love and we're so thrilled to have them, we are going to ask you all to head over to PCRF.net. That is the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. And if you are a fan of the show, if you're listening to the show and you're hearing this and you do have some money to spare, we are going to ask that in this time you send some money over there. That would really mean a lot to us. As such, we are also going to be donating all of our January Patreon funds to the PCRF as well. We just really think that at this time, that's something that's really important to do. So again, that is PCRF.net. That is the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. Anything you can give, it all goes towards helping children on the ground in Gaza and in the West Bank and in Palestine. So thank you all so much for listening, and we're going to get back to the show.
And we are back from Tokyo, if you will.
From Tokyo. We had to take the airplane back to Los Angeles. Yeah, he's from Los Angeles.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. He's an actor.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes reference to the home in L.A., I believe. This movie is very wistful. This
movie. Yes, correct, indeed. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I am full of wist. I've never been so chock-a-block full of wist before. It's a good one. I really like this movie. I liked it a lot. I think I'm probably going to like it more the more I watch it, the more I kind of settle into it. Want to discuss just every aspect of the vibes and the performances inherent in this movie. I think in the first half, I think I mentioned that there is the, you know, as to how much the two filmmakers talk about it, I don't think it's that much, but this is very much Sofia Coppola's breakup movie from Spike Jones and her, I think I mentioned this the first half, but like, you know, the rumor, the kind of inside joke, the like metatextual reference about her is that it's the same breakup from the other perspective. And I think I mentioned that with the plan of like, okay, that's a thing I know, cultural knowledge. It's not really something that I think is like so substantial that it needs to be spoken about. And then I watched this movie and I went, wow, her feels like a spiritual successor, like a nearly a direct sequel to this movie in terms of aesthetic and feel and emotion and vibe and sharing actors.
I was going to say, and featuring Scarlett Johansson.
Featuring Scarlett Johansson. And how could they have known? This one has Anna Faris in it. Her has Chris Pratt. Like, you know.
That's true. That is true.
Did Spike Jones break that couple up solely for a metatextual point in his AI romance movie? No, I don't think so. But, you know, it's interesting that that's the way that it went.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's, you know, I might dip into that. I think that's I want to rewatch her now with the knowledge of this. I mean, it's a known aesthetic. I mean, this movie is artistically very. I see a lot of movies cribbing from this playbook that aren't just her. I think it is. It's an aesthetic and a vibe that really was very, very influential. To say it. I think I made a joke on our like best of the year episode about All of Us Strangers, where I was like, well, if you're going to steal the aesthetic of a romance movie, you might as well steal hers. And now I'm like, oh no, they're stealing the Lost in Translation aesthetic.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It goes one step deeper.
Yeah, no, absolutely. My only other question, because we do have a game to get back to, is have you figured out an ironclad defense for exactly what you know for a fact Bill Murray says to her at the end, which is and something that you gleaned from all of the clues clearly left in the film, you know? Do you have your very do you have your 90-minute YouTube video essay ready?
It's not even a 90-minute. No, it's not even a 90-minute YouTube essay. It's like, I think it's really clear if you watch the movie and you listen to the weird overdubbed, like, watermelon voice that Bill Murray's doing. What he's saying is, it's the end of the movie. The script says, we have to kiss now. Isn't that right, ScarJo? Let's do it. And then they do it. It's a metatextual break. It's the end of the movie. What people don't understand is that these, like Deadpool, are two characters that know that they're in a film.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And they do a kiss. Yeah, obviously.
I have been saying this for years. Bill Murray is just like Deadpool, and Scarlett Johansson is just like Wolverine. Obviously.
Yeah. Of course.
No, but okay. That having been said, let us get back to our little game. This week we played Rotten Tomatoes Price is Right. And so let's just go ahead and jump on into this. For Lost in Translation, Carson, you said 92. I said 89. Having just finished rewatching this film, I am regretting that decision before I even pull up the thing. I should have gone over you. But let's find out. I locked in an 89, and Lost in Translation is 95% with 236 reviews. So the critics' consensus, effectively balancing humor and subtle pathos, Sofia Coppola crafts a moving, melancholy story that serves as a showcase for both Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson. I think that's extremely accurate.
Yep.
And again, like, we talk about this a lot in the yes, no, A, B, plus minus binary of Rotten Tomatoes. This film should definitely be a 95. Yeah. You know? I don't have much more to say about it than that. A great movie. The next film is Lost in Space, the 1998 William Hurt vehicle. Carson, you said 40. I said 25. And Lost in Space is 27%. So you've got one. I've got one. So we're going to move on to our third one. But really quickly, the critics' consensus for Lost in Space is clumsily directed and missing most of the TV series campy charm. Lost in Space sadly lives down to its title. Brutal.
I don't think that that's like a phrase. I don't think that lives down to its title. That's not a real thing people say.
I think that's a thing that people could say. I get it.
I've never heard that before. Okay.
Okay. Great. So the third and final film is Bill Murray's immediate follow-up to Lost in Translation, 2004's Garfield, the movie. Carson, you said 55. I said 58. I don't know why I said that. Oh my God.
Double bust?
It's a double bust.
Yeah, love it. Love it.
Garfield, the movie, clocks in with 135 reviews at a whopping 14%. The critics' consensus.
Movie's not good.
No, it's not. This is a movie that I saw in theaters as a 10-year-old. And said, I don't really like this. The critics' consensus, when the novelty of the CGI Garfield wears off, what's left is a simplistic kiddie movie. But kiddie, K-I-D-D-I-E, not K-I-T-T-Y.
Could go either
Garfield
way.
Because Garfield is a kiddie. We've got to quickly do a tiebreaker. So let's do, because you brought it up, let's do Spike Jonze's Her.
Okay. I thought you were going to say Tale of Two Kitties. All right.
Oh, that would have been also very funny.
Her's better, though. I'm trying to remember. Her is such a... The legacy of that film, I think, is a lot more difficult than that of Lost in Translation. Because I know a lot of people who just despise Her.
A take I don't like, but...
Yeah, a bad opinion that I disagree with. I think Her is fantastic. It's a masterpiece, but and that movie coming out in 2013, like the whole... I think that movie was a little bit ahead of its time in terms of subject matter, a little bit weirdly nostalgic for an aesthetic that the director's ex-wife had really helmed in the early 2000s. So it sits at a really weird time and place, I think, that film. But I love it. I'm going to say, I think this is low, but I want to be careful. So I'm going to say 80%.
80.
Yeah.
I'm going to say 87.
Okay.
That's fair. I think I remember this film getting pretty solid reviews, but you said 80, I said 87. Spike Jonze's yep. Her is 95. Wow. Same.
Shares a Rotten Tomatoes score
yep.
with Lost in Translation. Incredible.
Yep, the critics' consensus is sweet, soulful, and smart. Spike Jonze's Her uses its just barely sci-fi scenario to impart wryly funny wisdom about the state of modern human relationships.
Yeah.
Great. Well, so great game, Carson. Good game. My cap has been doffed to you. Good game. I take home the point this week, but that's unimportant. Let's talk Lost in Translation.
That's Lost in Translation. Okay, I have a question for you to start off this yes. conversation. And it's something that by the end of the movie I was not bothered by, but it's something that I was thinking about in the beginning. Because any movie that's about Hollywood actors, I think us movie folks, and I think a lot of general audiences too, you find yourself doing the like, all right, well, what kind of Hollywood actor is this? Like, who is the one-to-one comparison for this guy? Who the hell is, like, Bob Harris? Who is he? Like, who's he supposed to be? It's really weird because he's obviously played by Bill Murray. Bill Murray now, I think, is known also as dramatic actor between, like, this, his work with Wes Anderson, like he's really made his own as a legitimate, like, dramatic character actor, but is obviously one of the great legends of comedy, has a very specific persona. So this movie played by Bill Murray, but he's like kind of known widely for American action movies. But there's also the element of like, well, he's a little washed up, you know. ScarJo has the one line about all of his, you know, he hasn't really been making movies anymore. That was kind of in the past. That was like in the early 90s or the 80s, she had said. So like, is he like Bruce Willis? Is it a Bruce Willis? Bruce Willis, I think, actually has done Japanese alcohol ads, if I remember correctly.
I mean, probably. I mean, I don't know. I think for me, that doesn't really come up in my brain because it is so focused, right? Like, mm-hmm. this film starts with him getting to the hotel. Well, it technically starts with a shot of ScarJo without pants sleeping. That yes. is the, yes. like quite literally the opening shot, but the story proper, yeah. The first bit of action we see is him getting out of the car to the hotel. And then it ends with him getting back in the car to leave the hotel. So that doesn't really cross my mind. That doesn't really stick out to me because it's just like, okay, I know that this guy is. And I didn't get the sense that he was known for action movies because the guys are like, oh, did you do your own driving? Like, mm-hmm. I kind of got the sense of just like, that was a little like out of, you know, that was kind of surprising that he'd be doing something like that, or like, you know, at least like a novelty that he would be doing that. So I'm just kind of like, all right, this guy, I know two things about this guy. He's now doing commercials. He's kind of washed up. He's now doing commercials, but he has a big enough presence that people want him doing commercials, that he's a face, and yeah. that he did a action movie once. Right.
Yeah.
So
true.
I don't know. I guess Bruce Willis is kind of a good one. I kind of just think of it as alternate universe Bill Murray, where sort of,
sure.
you know, like, I mean, that's the thing is Bill Murray, like, quietly has never stopped working. Like,
yeah.
you think of Bill Murray as like, okay, he's like a 70s, 80s guy, right? Like late 70s SNL. And then the 80s were his decade. And now he's a guy who just like shows up and does stuff, which is true. But it's like, if you scroll through his credits,
Dude has 98 acting credits that have been released, the 98th one being Ghostbusters Frozen Empire.
Oh, God. He is in Ghostbusters Frozen Empire.
And it's I'm scrolling back, and there's, like, not a year where he's not in anything. Okay, 95, he has a gap. He has Ed Wood in 94 and Kingpin in 96, but he's got three releases in 96. He's got two releases in 94, two releases in 93, you know, a break in 92, a film in 91, a film in 90, 89, 88, 88, 87. Like, the dude just quietly never stopped working. But so I kind of view this as, like, let's say we get to 90, like 90, no, let's say we get to 94. He does Ed Wood. He does Kingpin in 96. Maybe he still does his cameo-ish role in Space Jam in 96. And then instead of doing Rushmore and Hamlet, you know, instead of doing Rushmore 98 and Hamlet in 2000,
mm-hmm.
it's just like, I think that he just kind of stops after 96 or is just doing, like, stunt roles, you know, like maybe he only does Osmosis Jones. You know, this is the year, like, this Bill Murray is the Bill Murray that does Osmosis Jones in 2001, but doesn't also do the Royal Tenenbaums in 2001.
Yeah. Oh, have you ever seen Osmosis Jones? That movie's fucking weird.
I don't think I ever did. I think it really weirded me out as a kid. I did not like it.
We might do Osmosis Jones next. That would actually, okay, wait, we're going to put that in the calendar. Osmosis Jones would actually be a really good movie for this podcast. That movie is really good. The Bill Murray stuff is actually kind of weird and bad and unsettling. Bill Murray is incredible in this movie. I'm not going to go against the grain and say the performance is bad. And also,
phenomenal.
Yeah, I think it's a fun thought exercise to kind of do the, okay, what kind of career is this? But it does fundamentally not matter to this movie.
Right, correct.
This movie is very, like, nearly everything about this movie's plot feels like set dressing for what the movie is actually about, which is about, like, just vibing on the experience of being lonely and feeling unmoored in an otherwise beautiful place. And, like, the odd bittersweet romance that evolves between these two very different people that just so happen to brush up against each other at a very particular place at a very particular time. And, like, you know, like, the actual literal facts of, well, this is who this guy is. This is why he's in Japan. This is why he feels so, like, why he's feeling these particular emotions about going through this rigmarole, why he's going to be there for longer than he thought he would. That is, like, important to get him to that place. It's important to know, oh, you know, ScarJo's husband is a photographer. That's why she's here. She just graduated college. That's why she feels unmoored. He doesn't, you know, really give her the time of day anymore. Like, that is all important to the soup that makes the thing that this movie is actually about, which is these two people looking at each other for a long, long time. But Bill Murray, I don't think that I'm talking out of school with saying that, like, this movie is, I think, a bit of a turning point for Bill Murray, because
no longer
is he just, you know, the comedic persona Bill Murray, who, as much as he was not headlining studio comedies in the 90s, is in all these movies that you're discussing kind of brought in as a stunt cast, not even in things that, like, aren't Space Jam, in which he's playing Bill Murray. Bill Murray is used in this very wink, wink, nod way, even today in a lot of films, of like, 100%. Hey, guys, it's Bill Murray. Don't you get how it's Bill Murray? There's this, like, not only the, because his comedic persona is so wink, wink, nod, nod. He always, you know, in the 80s and early 90s plays these characters that the reason that they're fun is that they're kind of sitting on top of the movie in this almost Bugs Bunny-esque way. He can very nearly look at the camera and wink at the audience and be like, yeah, I know what's going on here. This is a film in which not only is he in a drama, he's the lead, and he is playing it so goddamn straight, such that, like, any bit of comedy is not, like, is about him being powerless. It's kind of the opposite. It's about he has no idea what's going on in this situation. It's about there is literally, you know, these things that are lost in translation. It's about these things that he cannot seem to communicate with people. People cannot communicate with him, even when they're not speaking literally in a language that he does not share, like, because he feels so unmoored. Like, compared to what Murray usually shows, this guy who is riding on top of the movie, who can just look at the audience and say, hey, look, I know every, like, I'm going to kind of play with this situation because I know everything that's going on here. This is a film that, like, puts this guy in a position of relative power, but absolute helplessness.
Yeah.
And that stands in stark contrast to everything that he'd done before.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, you're 100% right. It's like, I mean, if you kind of look at Bill Murray's career, I mean, so he has Groundhog Day in 93, yeah, which is like one of the last times. And like, that is like a Bill Murray movie, you know, that is like a film that is built around, like, we've got Bill Murray, like, above it's a Bill title. Murray comedy. He's in the lead. Like, but that's kind of one of the few times where it's like, really after that, where it's like, he is like an actor, you know what I mean? And it's like, he's a movie star. It really is a movie star casting for Groundhog Day, but it's like, he is playing a character and like Bill Murray is playing it because it is a character that is built around his comedy stylings. Right.
Yeah.
In 97, you have The Man Who Knew Too Little, which is kind of just another one of those. It's another one of those movies. That's like, oh, and then we're doing a comedy and Bill Murray's in it. And that one doesn't really work. That one doesn't really like connect with people. Like, it's not really good. And then from there, it's like, beyond that, it really is like what you're talking about, like the stunt casting. And I don't even mean stunt casting in terms of like, it's cheap or anything, but it's just like, it's almost like a project gets blessed. And I kind of feel this way about this film too, where it's like the film gets blessed by Bill Murray being like, oh, and I'm going to give you some cachet. Like, I'm going to be in this. Like, I mean, like, he's Polonius in the Ethan Hawke Hamlet. You know what I mean? Like, if he wanted to be, he could have been, you know, he could have been a Claudius or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, that is a role that it's like kind of small for Bill Murray, but it's like, that's what he's doing. And same thing too with like Bosley and Charlie's Angels, right? And the like Royal Tenenbaums. He's like, I mean, he had worked with Wes Anderson before on Rushmore, obviously, but it is kind of the thing where it's like, he's blessing so many of these projects with like his presence. And I do kind of feel that way about this movie too. But the difference is I feel like with this movie, that is all like Hollywood inside baseball, like big picture meta text, where with those other films, it is kind of like it's kind of like incorporated into the text of the film that like Bill Murray's playing this role.
Yeah.
Like, I think Bill Murray being like, no, I like, cause I think this is only Sofia Coppola's second movie. I think she had done The Virgin Suicides before this. Suicides. And then, and so it's kind of like, look, like he's like, you know, there's this young director, like kind of like Hollywood royalty. She made a great movie. She's trying to do a second one. She's trying to get her sophomore feature, like, off the ground. I'm going to do it. Like, and then he is in, you know, and then she, you know, she clearly, he like likes her and respects her. Like, she directs his Christmas special in 2015, which, did you ever watch that, by the way?
No, I've heard both that and On the Rocks are, like, not great.
It's very strange. It's kind of like this. It's kind of like if Lost in Translation was a Christmas movie, in a weird way. But yeah, so it's kind of, but that is the thing where it's like Bill Murray as a force in Hollywood is kind of doing his stunt casting thing in this movie. But in terms of the performance he's giving, in terms of the way he is utilized in the film, I almost feel like so much of the juice of this movie is like, oh shit, like Bill Murray is in this movie and he's not doing the Bill Murray thing. I should kind of pay attention to this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if Bill Murray is going to give a very sensitive, sincere, dramatic performance, like in this movie, and is not going to do his Bill Murray thing, mm-hmm, that must mean this is like kind of important, right? Like, I should probably pay attention to this.
Two things. One, I mean, and this is something that he never quite recaptures, you know, the absolute high of this dramatic role. I think partially to the extent that Bill Murray, maybe more than trying to think of any other actor, has kind of become so subsumed by like the image of what Bill Murray is. Like, I think of like all those memes, and you know, probably part of the reason that the memes are funny is that they play with this idea of everyone knows the image of Bill Murray and what he represents and what his personality is and what he brings to the table, of like the so many memes of like, oh, Bill Murray walked up to me at McDonald's and ate a couple of fries off my plate and said, gave me a wink and said, you can't ever tell it. No one will ever believe you that this happened. And like, yeah, that is a funny, that joke does not work with any other actor. Despite the fact that, like, in life, yeah, hypothetically, that is a funny thing that a really well-known actor could do to somebody. It'd be like, hey, nobody's going to believe that you tell your friends that Tom Cruise came up and took a bite out of your cheeseburger. Nobody's going to fucking believe you. It's too ridiculous. But, like, we as an audience, because we're so associated in our minds with, like, the generalized image of what Bill Murray's persona is, like, that joke makes sense that it's Bill Murray, even if that never happened, because it probably never did, you know? The other thing is, like, weirdly, his performance in this movie and the pretty glowing critical reception to it kind of makes, and again, I think this is apocryphal. I don't know how true this is. I don't know if this is just Bill Murray saying this is a joke to kind of get out of it. But, like, it almost lends credence to the whole, like, well, he only took Garfield because he thought the Coen brothers were directing it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Thing.
Which, yeah. Again, that is one of those, like, James Cameron turns the S into, yeah, a dollar sign. It's one of those things. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, I don't know if it's that straightforward and that simple, but like, boy, is that just like a piece of like a one sentence of very reduced Hollywood history that I just really, yes, hope is true. It is a fantastic, yes, one sentence story. And I really hope it's true. It's probably, yeah, not so simple, but if there's even a grain of truth in there, let's say that's just how it went down.
Yeah. So for those of you out there listening who maybe don't know this story that I'm talking about. So the story that Bill Murray tells as to why he took the titular role of Garfield in 2002's Garfield, the movie.
2004, how dare you? It's a follow-up to
2004.
Two Lost in Translation.
Is that he was essentially like, his agent was like, hey, they want you to do this Garfield movie. He's like, what? And his agent, like, he just saw the top sheet. And Garfield was co-written, I think, by, I'm looking at his name, not Joel Cohen of the Coen brothers.
Yeah, not Joel Cohen. Joel Cohen.
Cohen. Yes, Cohen. Yes, and I think he might have been attached, you know, whatever, was at some point. And just saw.
Yeah, he's a credited screenwriter on the film.
Yes, saw that and was like, oh, this is a Coen brothers movie. I don't care what it is. Put me in it. And then took the role. Now, Bill Murray tells that story. I don't know how true it is. Maybe it represents some aspect of the truth. But it does kind of fit with where he's at in this part in his career. You can imagine after this turn in Lost in Translation, somebody comes up to, you know, the Coen brothers say, hey, man, we have this role for you. And they seem like such a perfect, you know, the kind of blends of genre or drama and comedy that the Coen brothers were making, especially in the late 90s and early aughts, feels like a really kind of perfect next step from this. Of like, we're not going to really quite trade in on Bill Murray's persona as much. It's not going to be as nakedly dramatic. He can still kind of use his comedic chops, but ultimately he's going to be the lead in this very emotionally real dramatic film. You know, mm-hmm, the way that like Nicolas Cage turns in a really fantastically funny, but ultimately emotionally real performance in Raising Arizona, you can imagine Bill Murray fitting into a Coen Brothers movie.
Oh, 100%. I mean, my gosh. It is kind of crazy. It's okay. Hear me out. Do you agree with this? It is kind of crazy that Bill Murray is so good at comedy and, mm-hmm, is so good at being the lead of a comedy film that he kind of can't do it anymore. It's like, because you
they've done all the Bill Murray movies, right? Like, you've made Groundhog Day. You can't just do that again. So he kind of, he does have to go and do all of these like stunt roles in art films and like does have to do kind of more like niche kind of interesting stuff because he's just so good and so specific and so keyed in that like, it's kind of impossible to just like make a Bill Murray movie again.
I don't know. Maybe the, and it's going the other direction. It's largely dramatic, but it's, and I think the reason it works is because the world around him is so ridiculous. But like, I think the best he works, the maybe the least he's trading in on Bill Murray, the persona, Bill Murray, the character is like in Life Aquatic. Like, yeah, that's a very funny, right. ridiculous movie, but his performance in that, it's kind of weirdly similar in some ways to his performance in this in terms of him being this, like, washed-up has-been. But he's not super Bill Murray forward in that movie, and he's really good. Yeah, it's odd. I mean, I also think, and it is something else that this movie made me think of a lot, is that, like, I think we've talked about it in the show a long time ago because we like to talk about, you know, the death of studio comedies, but it's this thing that Judd Apatow or Adam McKay, I think it was Adam McKay, was talking about when they released Vice, and he was saying that, like, well, the pace of studio comedy just changed fundamentally when digital filmmaking got popular in the late 90s, early 2000s, when that really took over and it became popular to just do the Judd Apatow, Adam McKay thing, just shoot a lot of footage as much as you want and then just edit it within an inch of its life to like the absolute tightest, most funniest, most like tightly timed bit of comedy. Bill Murray's comedic sensibility and his persona are very slow, very lackadaisical. There's a lot of air in Bill Murray performances. It's something that really works in this. He matches the kind of slow, lackadaisical aesthetic of Lost in Translation very well. Like, it is the thing that makes him unlike Bugs Bunny in that he sits on top of the film and kind of looks down at it winking, but whereas Bugs Bunny has a lot of kind of manic energy, Bill Murray has none of that. He can take his time. He's not all that worried about anything coming to get him. Yeah. And that just does not, I can't see, because of that, I can't see a Bill Murray performance slotting very easily into, you know, I don't know, 21 Jump Street or Popstar or any of the like really actually great studio comedies that I've loved over the past decade.
Yeah, no, 110%. Yeah. I think it's kind of a changing times thing. I mean, like, to some degree, like if we look at the 90s and we think of that, like, quote unquote, like the whole death of history thing, like, I mean, this film is really kind of tapping into a slightly post version of that, of just like, of just that ennui of just like, oh my God, none of this fucking means anything. Like, this is all, you know, and there is that thing in the 90s of like, you know, everything is perfect. History is done. We've just like, we made society. Let's go. Right. And then like Bill Murray. So the presence that's needed in those, in like the 80s and 90s. And let me say here, for mainstream white American audiences, let's be clear, is just this thing of like, just this kind of lackadaisical, this kind of like melancholic, just like, what the fuck are we doing here, you guys? Like none of this makes any, like, we're okay with this, because that is kind of the ethos of the time, is like, and everything's perfect, we're done. And that Bill Murray of just like kind of looking around and being like this is kind of stupid, like that's very important. And it does kind of become this thing post 9/11, post the 2000s, especially as we get into the 2010s and especially into the 2020s, of like you're saying, like, studio comedy does become, and just comedy in general, does become so much more madcap and so much zanier, because the anxieties of the times are so much higher. Like, the popular anxiety of the time is so much higher. And so it's like, for Bill Murray to work, it kind of has to be, he does kind of have to be the elder statesman of comedy, of like, I'm coming in and I'm blessing this thing. And I am, you know, like, and I am you know, how do I phrase this? Like, he kind of has to step in and be like,
rancid legitimacy.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't fit into the center of this film. Mm-hmm. I will be here, as the elder statesman to just be like, hello, it's me. I bless this comedy. It is correct. I am here. However, I cannot be at the center of it because nobody wants to see a movie about a white guy who's kind of a little over all of this when the problems are at the center of our comedies is like, like the economy is crumbling. Fascism is on the rise. We're all pulling our hair out. Why did our parents do this to us? Like, you can't kind of put Bill Murray at the center of that for better or for worse. And I think there for the is worst this- of the genre of filmmaking anyway, or the medium of filmmaking.
Yeah. There is this trade-off in the 2000s, and I'm developing, listening to everything you're saying, I'm developing this theory on the fly, so I don't know how airtight it is. But there is this, I think that there's this resonance to say the fact that, like, Talladega Nights is kind of what, the most important comedy film of the 2000s.
I would kind of say it's Anchorman, but go on.
Here's my argument for Talladega Nights is because it also marries, it is fundamentally a satire that marries very well with, the other side of the death of history thing. It's that movie so post 9/11. And it, I think, kind of pokes, and Anchorman gets at this too, but it really points towards a sea change of the leads in our comedy films are likable and shitty, but not that ridiculous. They're likable because they're just super normal ass dudes. Whereas in Talladega Nights and Anchorman, they all turn into, you know, they all turn into friggin' Dogberry. They're like ridiculous idiots. They're like way overconfident. Like, that is the joke of Anchorman, is that, like, look, our lead is this overconfident shithead, and he represents everything that America thinks it loves about itself, but actually is like the rotten core of the culture. Like, these are the guys that, like, the current American ecosystem, like, holds up as heroes.
Yeah,
there's a Bill Murray does not fit in that ecosystem. Yeah, Anchorman has that too, obviously.
That's also my read on Anchorman.
Place in the 70s. Yeah.
But it's kind of that thing of like the culture we have inherited is based on. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And this movie, I think, skirts. And I get, if you watch this movie and you're like, this is, you know, two very well-off white people having some real just ennui about the world. Fuck that. I'm not interested in that. Yeah, sure. Fine. I think that this movie largely gets away with that because it's not like, look at these two people and how much they're suffering. It's like, look at, despite the fact that these two people like fundamentally have everything that the world and like Western capitalist society tells them they should want, fame, especially Bill Murray, fame and fortune and, you know, high social status and regard, they're still fucking empty. There's just nothing in there.
No, I know. No, I mean, I think,
and like,
I think
that's the great tragedy.
I think you are dead on. Is it's not the ennui and the quote unquote tragedy of this film is not, oh, look at these white people. Don't they deserve better? It's, hey, look at these white people who ostensibly have everything our society values, mm-hmm. and they are not happy. Like, they are just as empty inside because what they don't have is people in their life who give a shit about them. They have the fame. They have the fortune. Well, Bill Murray has the fame. Bill Murray has the fortune. Scarlett Johansson has the, in the very Sofia Coppola, like, woman in the nicest cage you've ever seen, mold. Like, she has the thing that women are quote unquote supposed to want, which is like the uber successful husband who can take her on work trips to all of these amazing cities all around the globe. But like, that doesn't actually mean anything if you're just sitting in your very nice, very expensive hotel room and nobody in your world values you as a person or what you or who you are, what you have to say. Yeah. And I think that's like the important distinction here is it's not a film. Again, it isn't a film where, you know, by meeting one another, it doesn't have the Back to the Future ending problem, basically, right? Like, it doesn't.
No.
It's not by meeting each other and saving them, then they get to, or like, and saving each other
by being pals, then they both figure out a way to win capitalism. It's like, you know, it doesn't have the thing where it's like Bill Murray then, through meeting ScarJo, like realizes his career is a sham and gets a new artistic wind and makes a lot of money. You know, like that's not the thing. The ultimate victory / bittersweet note that it ends on is like, oh, and then they finally connect. And guess what? It's bringing us to the very ending. It's bringing us to the thing that weirdos love to debate and love to have fan theories about. But they finally have a thing that is just for them.
Mm-hmm.
It is just
a language that only they can understand.
Yep. Yes. And yes. There is a moment that they share that the only people on the planet that it matters to or would mean anything to is the two of them. And to the two of them, it means everything.
Yeah. I want to talk about ScarJo.
Yes, let's do it.
There is, and the way I want to get into that, because I want to hear your take on this. I have not like read the, I've said that, you know, I usually have like the Wikipedia page open for the movie we're talking about in the side, just in case you go up in a name or you want to look up a date or whatever.
Right. Yeah. I always currently have six IMDb tabs open for Bill Murray, Royal Tenenbaums, Moses Jones, Garfield, the movie, Joel Cohen and Sofia Coppola.
Yeah.
Go on.
But under so I've not read this, but I think it's significant that like on the left-hand side for the Wikipedia page drop-down list, there's like analysis, you know, pretty common subset Wikipedia articles for critically acclaimed movies that are have some artistic depth. Yes. Themes. Yes. Narrative. Yes. And then there's an entire subsection dedicated solely to opening shot.
I am going to, this is the end of the podcast. Thank you all so much for listening. I am going to retreat into the woods, never to speak to another human being again. That is the worst thing I've ever heard. I fucking hate this universe. You should all be ashamed of yourselves. Carson, go on.
What if I don't know, I'm not Reddit, but what if I clicked on it and the entire paragraph was just like fucking hot, right?
It's just nice with like 17 eyes.
I think, I don't know. I find that to be interesting, especially like there's not a subsection for the thing we were just talking about, like the what did he say to her, the thing that is the great, it's a purposeful mystery, obviously, like you said. I agree with your read on that. Like, that is what the statement is. They're finally speaking a language that only the two of them understand. We as the audience are now the one that's losing that translation, whatever. But like that is like that's something that like you would expect to have that. That is like kind of one of the great legacies of this film. It's something I brought up that I knew about before I had watched it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that the opening shot's the thing. And I think it's an ambiguous opening shot. I don't know. I maybe got to watch it another time or two before I'm like, okay, this is exactly the thing that Coppola is getting at with it. But it's interesting to me that that's the one. Like, is it just because, like, truly it's when America first saw Scarlett Johansson's ass? Like, is it that crude? But it was, like, a confusing ass. It wasn't, you know?
Yeah.
An ass that kept you guessing.
Yeah, let me see here. So my first exposure to this film was in college. We actually read, it was in my screenwriting course, and the structure that I've talked about it before on the podcast, but the structure of that course was we were assigned to read the script first, and then we'd have a discussion about the script as it was written, and then we would then watch the film. And so it kind of brought up this thing of like, okay, what is the screenwriter's thoughts in all of this? So I have read the screenplay, but I'm pulling it up right now. So yes, technically in the shooting script, it is written that there is one shot prior, but it is an airport. We hear the sound of a plane landing. Oh no, over black. Yeah. And then it is written, the back of a girl in pink underwear. She leans at a big window looking out over Tokyo. Melodramatic music swells over the girl's butt in pink to sheer underwear as she lies on the bed. Title cards over image, lost in translation, cut to the car at night. So it is written in the script.
very specifically, she said, we will be looking at butt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, I think there's a few ways you can read it, but I just think it's, I mean, I think it's a vulnerability thing. I think it's like, you know, it is her being both like very safe in terms of like very safe in the physically in the place she's in, that she can be, you know, undressed and vulnerable. And also it is a thing of like, you know, I mean, not to be crude on the pod, but like that is a good butt. Like Scarlett Johansson has a really good butt. And I think it's a thing that like Sofia Coppola, as like a woman, a young woman, especially directing this film, it's like there is kind of this, it's almost like a call, I guess I don't know if I should use the word calling card necessarily, but it's almost like an artistic statement of like, you are about to watch a movie that can shoot a very nice butt that every straight man in the world wishes he, you know, could see and touch, and most of the women in the world are conditioned to want to have for themselves, and that butt is going to make you feel lonely and sad. And like, that is the visual language of this film. That is the ethos of Sofia Coppola as a writer director.
Yeah,
like for this film, and this is like just from straight up, like look at this good butt. Doesn't it mean nothing if you are lonely and sad?
Mm-hmm. Very true. Very true. And it does, you know, I think about that opening image and also just the film's willingness to, because it's not like, you know, there's part of the cinematic language and also it's all tied up in the male gaze and all that. But like, there are ways to shoot a like scantily clad woman that solely showed them as vulnerable, as like entirely like, look, they are undressed either because they feel safe in the situation or because they have been made to feel unsafe, they're uncovered. This movie does that sometimes, but there are scenes in which they're not sexualizing Scarlett Johansson's body. There are times when that occurs. And I think about that especially as compared to like in Priscilla, which is also a woman trapped in a beautiful cage movie, in which that does not happen. Kaylee Spaney's body is never sexualized in that movie.
Well, right.
Like if she is in a sexual situation, it is either scary or very frustrating. There's no lewd release in that film compared to this one, in which Sofia Coppola goes into this and being like, yeah, Scarlett Johansson is beautiful and you are going to experience her beauty as though you are seeing it firsthand. And that's also, I think, important to priming your brain for the very odd relationship that she has with Bill Murray, because it's never as though he actively flirts with her. But because you've noticed that she's sexually attractive, you know that he has too.
Right.
Like that is implied.
Right. And it is a thing too, where it's like, you know, you mentioned in the first half, you know, about, you mentioned in the first half, like, oh, and then he like carries on a romance with Scarlett Johansson. And, you know, partially just to not, like, spoil things, I was kind of like, well, is it romantic? But also, like, they kiss, they flirt. Mm-hmm. But it is a thing where it's, like, it is hard to say that this is an intimate relationship where they are, like, a romantic relationship where they are into one another. And it's kind of hard to argue that it's not. You know what I'm saying? Like, it is just such a, like, emotionally intimate relationship that like it almost kind of doesn't matter. You know what I'm saying? Like she both gets kind of jealous like when he sleeps with the singer, but also like they both know that it's like, and that's the thing, is he gets kind of like, oh shit, I've been caught, but it's like more importantly they're like, oh, you're cheating on your wife with this person. And like, you know, and like, yeah, like you probably shouldn't be doing that, huh? But like, there's that unspoken thing of like, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's hard to kind of put a really clear label or box on this thing.
There is the kind of two things that I like the most about this movie. Obviously, I just think that like aesthetically and formally, it really sells the idea of isolation and loneliness really well. I think that like that controlling idea, obviously, the film's got a perfect title, like the idea of things being lost in translation, you know, like not being able to communicate with the world around you in a really profound way is sold in just about every creative decision that's made in this film. So, and aesthetically, it sells that loneliness and that desperation while remaining to look beautiful and just have vibes out the wazoo. The other thing that I love about this movie is how strange and kind of unknowable the relationship between these two characters are, because it's quasi-romantic and it's quasi-parental and it's also very platonic at times, and it's hard to put your finger on as somebody watching it from the outside, and that's what's so interesting about it. Because what it fundamentally is just two people that happen to be connecting at this time. And it's, and because you're watching this film in which no other person ever like actually one-on-one connects with any other person in the film, the fact that the two of these people are feels electric, no matter what exactly it is, whether it is sexual or romantic or whatever. Like, and yeah, it's strange. And it goes back to what you said about the final, you know, the whisper in the ear of it's the nature of their relationship with one another is something that we can't really know. And maybe they don't really know, because it's not as though it, you know, it's not, you could see, I think it's a bad decision and it's not what Sofia Coppola wants to do. It'd be an entirely different movie, but like you can kind of see, given the plot setup of this movie, how it turns into Before Sunset, but it's not. They kiss and they smile at each other and then they leave happily. Like there is this recognition of, well, this is a moment in time. This relationship is a very specific, very kind of almost sacred thing that we can't repeat again.
Yeah. No, yeah. 110%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Good movie. Giovanni Ribisi's there.
Good. He's good. Yeah. Looks like Spike Jones. Looks a lot like Spike Jones.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Yeah, he does.
No, I know.
Yeah, yeah. I want to, because, look, one, I've seen this movie one time. Two, I am white and not, you know, not the final word on any of these things. But I do want to give note of, like, there's a lot of criticism in this movie of being kind of orientalist. Again, if you, I say this all the time, if you find offense with something, or, and obviously I think that there is a lot to say about, like, the specific nature of how othered cultures are, like how they are used in film and in art generally. And that's like a very deep talk that you can have about this movie. But like just looking on Letterboxd, a lot of the like negative reviews of this movie are just like racist. And I don't see that. And I think this is another thing you talk about a lot, Caroline. Like maybe this is just my like, you know, white guilt lefty, you know, culturally knowledgeable, like white American brain kind of justifying this in my own watching of it, or maybe it's actually in the film. I don't know. I don't find any of the Japanese, I mean, there's two characters in this film. I think that's something to be said. It's a, you know, takes place in Japan. There are no Japanese characters. There's only two characters. I don't find the depiction of Japanese culture to be that ridiculous.
No, I mean, yes, I pretty much agree. I think it is. Yeah, like, I don't think the people, are ever the butt of the joke. I think.
No.
It's never, because like, even the director, I do not watch that first scene where Bill Murray's shooting the commercial and think, oh my God, like this director like sucks. I think, yeah. Oh yeah, that's what a film director is like, you know, like that's a very intense artistic guy. But I don't think the film is really like the whole conflict of the scene is just like there are two artists being like having a conversation through a interpreter who is not like artistically minded,
And so he's like Bill Murray is not like, there's no point where Bill Murray is like, oh my God, this fucking idiot, this guy sucks. He literally is like, it's like, no, like he's the director and it seems like he has a lot to say. Like, it seems like there's a lot he wants me to understand. And like, I would like to understand him.
Yeah.
It's not like a, oh, how stupid is this? Like, once I get to understand it, this guy is so stupid. It's like, it is a thing of him very literally being like, no, I want to understand what is going on. I just don't. Like, could someone help me? It is. Yeah. So, I mean, I tend to agree. Like, I guess there could be like an argument that's made of like, no, because see, I don't know. I was going to say, like, I feel like somebody could make an argument that, like, oh, it is, like, it's, like, romanticizing, you know, like, it's romanticizing Tokyo and not really, like, engaging with it, but it's, like...
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't really...
It's also just so... That is so not what the movie's about. Again, there are
two characters
in this movie. Everyone else is... archetypical. Everyone else is a background extra.
Yeah.
The character that is the most nakedly ridiculous and like looked at with the most scorn is the white actress that is there. And like the things that are ridiculous about like, you know, the director of the commercial like that, I don't think there's anything like, I think the movie's making fun of that guy a little bit, but I don't think that anything that's being made fun about him has anything to do with his Japanese-ness. It's all about like, he is a commercial director that's taking himself very seriously. You can tell he thinks he's a much greater artistic force than he actually is.
For sure.
And yeah, and like, again, I'm not trying to discount, like, obviously, I think this is the case with film, is that all art is political. And I think that like there are probably a number of very deep, like actually well considered and deeply like critically held arguments that one could make about this movie that deal with like it as a piece in a legacy of the West's Orientalist views and like what it means when you set just what it means generally when you set a movie about two white people in Tokyo. What does that pretend? I just don't understand the like Letterboxd reaction that's just like, this movie's disgusting. What a horrible, I'm like, I just don't see that. Like maybe I'm not looking hard enough, but I don't see it. Maybe there's also maybe an aspect, there's maybe a Silence of the Lambs aspect to it too. Of like the, well, in the course of this film, I don't think that this artistic work necessarily says anything negative about the group that's being depicted. But as a piece in the longer legacy of Western Orientalist media, sure, it's there. It's impossible to not see it when you're looking at it.
Right. No, 100%.
Yeah. Not trying to completely wash away any and all critique, but also I think there's an element of it that I'm like, I'm curious about. I don't necessarily see that.
No, definitely.
ScarJo is very good in this movie. I do just want to say that. We never actually got to talking about her. We got stuck on the butt, which, hey, maybe that's Sofia Coppola's point.
I don't think it is.
But she's really brilliant. It's a performance from her that I think is really unusual, knowing her, the kinds of roles that she tends to play now. Because I now think of Scarlett Johansson as somebody who is very assured of herself, very steely, very hard-edged. I mean, part of that's the Black Widow of it all, certainly, but also I think that extends to a lot of her roles. And this character is, it's Coppola's whole point, is that like she is a person who is distinct from her husband and is having an entire interior world, but she is very demure and very, very low-key, very submissive in a way that Scarlett Johansson never is.
Right. Because I mean, before this, her biggest film is Ghost World. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm looking here on her IMDb.
16.
So I mean, it is certainly not what she would go on to do. But I think, I mean, I do think that it is a great performance and something that I find really interesting. I don't know. I find it very interesting. The kind of dynamic between these two characters and kind of like the multiple, you know, kind of like the multiple identities of Sofia Coppola herself. I mean, like it is very interesting to me that it focuses on a,
the two roles are, the two leads of this film are a young woman who has everything she wants because of the men in her life, who just kind of like has this, you know, has this station in life of like, I don't have any material concerns in the world, because I am around successful men, successful artistic men. And then the flip side of that is a successful artist who is in, who is a significantly older man, who she both gets and couldn't be further away from, period. Yeah. And I think that's really cool. And I like that in the Scarlett Johansson role of like, I like that she's not an artist. You know, I like that it's not a...
Yeah, well, she is maybe, but she doesn't know what kind. Like, that's the other kind of interesting thing, the conversation she has about, like, well, I got out of college and I thought about writing and nothing I wrote was that good. And I thought about photography and, you know, it's all kind of... And also, I think the photography thing in particular, the way she talks about it, you do, it does lead you to wonder, wait, are her photos actually that bad or are they just not as good as her... Like, not quite as good as her very successful photographer husband's. And that keeps her from it.
Or are they just as good and nobody gives a shit?
Yeah.
Like,
and you can imagine, like, inserting Sofia Coppola into it, not just the Spike Jonze of it, but, like, when Francis Ford Coppola is your dad and maybe you want to be a director, that's a big ask. That's a, well, shit, am I ever going to make anything that's even half as good as The Godfather? You know, that's, I would imagine that's probably going through Sophia's mind at some point. That's, I think, kind of a natural thing for a human being to go through in that situation.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that, and the thing is she will make a film that is half as good as The Godfather. She'll go on to make Priscilla, which fucking rules. And also, like, several other films, but...
some other ones, Marie Antoinette, whatever, you know.
I've not seen Marie Antoinette, but like the reclamation of that one, I am very excited to watch it hopefully very soon.
I watched it in high school and I don't think I got it. I think I want to rewatch it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Talk about a woman in a beautiful cage movie.
Literally, yeah.
You know, I know, that's what I'm saying. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I do love the Scarlett Johansson performance. I think
that's really good.
It is very good. I don't want to sit here and psychoanalyze Sofia Coppola too much, but
No. Yeah,
I do enjoy that. Like, again, her conflict is not. I think a much worse version of this movie is Scarlett Johansson has what it takes to be a really successful artist. And just like can't get that foot in the door or whatever, like can't be taken seriously.
Yeah, no.
It's more just like I don't know, maybe she's got it, maybe she doesn't. It doesn't really matter. Because like she said either way, and that's kind of what's sad, is it kind of doesn't matter what she does because she's always gonna be set. She never has to attain anything greater than what she has right now, which is, you know, a bummer for her.
Yeah, I said this at the beginning, I'm reiterating it in a different way, but it's fundamentally why this movie works for me, because everything else, the set dressing, the actual circumstance, the quote unquote plot, the locations, all of that is set dressing. It's all just there to like fill in the world and to lead to the thing that this is actually about, which is that as a human being, we only experience ourselves in the eyes of others. Like, we are social creatures. And when we are cut off, when we feel lonely, when we are depressed, when we are in some way fundamentally cut off from the rest of humanity, like that is as beautiful as your life can be otherwise, that itself is a kind of suffering. And when we do see ourselves in the eyes of others, when we do truly connect, those are the moments of purest beauty in the human experience. And like, that's what this movie is about. It's about two people being in a place, both physically and metaphorically and spiritually, in which they are completely at odds with the rest of the world. They are cut off from, you know, the base nature of their lives and feel adrift. And in finding each other, feel less adrift. That's what the movie's about. It's not about any of the other stuff. That's what it's about.
I agree.
Yeah. Yep. Good movie. I liked it a lot.
Me too.
Thanks for making me watch it.
You are very welcome. Thank you for watching it and liking it.
Yeah. Centauri Whiskey, pretty good.
Hey, when you need it to be make it Centauri time.
You know, this is just fun whiskey facts. Do you know that Centauri Whiskey owns Jim Beam?
I did not.
It's the world's largest liquor conglomerate, Centauri Beam. Yeah.
I love that.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
Pretty cool. All right. Well, I think that's it.
I agree.
It's Lost in Translation.
Yeah. Corey, do you want to tell the nice folks where they can find us on the internet?
Absolutely. If you like what you hear, please be sure to like us and subscribe wherever you stream your podcasts. Leaving a review would also really help out the visibility of the show. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, all at HHYNSpod. Special thank you to our patrons. If you'd like a shout out on the show and bonus content, head over to our Patreon at patreon.com/HHYNSpod.
All right.
Corey,
tell Corey what we're going to do.
Yeah, so what we're going to do, Corey, on this recording is you are going to get the end of Lost in Translation, where we announce that JJ is indeed coming on the podcast next week to talk Solaris. Then you will get the pre-theme song intro for Prisoners and the Muppet Movie, because we've confirmed that we are doing a Solaris episode before then, so we're going to get the "you really haven't seen Solaris" in those intros, so... Well, I think that's Lost in Translation.
I'm so sad and so alienated.
Yes.
So next week, are we gonna do a movie that's not gonna make me feel grief and like I'm being alienated,
sad and
from
alienated?
People around me and huh?
Or sad or alienated? Yeah, I'm yes anding.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Like, are we doing something nice and warm and fuzzy?
Well, you know, I honestly can't tell you, because next week we have a guest coming on the show who I must give them the utmost credit, because every time we have a guest on this show, we try to be very accommodating hosts. We try to be very, respectful of what they want to do and what they want out of this experience. So we always give folks the option of bringing us a film, or we can assign them a film. And everyone says, hell no, I want you to make me watch a film. That's what this podcast is about. However, next week, we have a guest coming on the show. He has been on the show before. JJ Birsch, researcher extraordinaire over from Blank Check with Griffin and David, is joining the podcast next week, where he is finally taking us up on the offer of him showing us one of his favorite movies that we haven't seen. So I have not seen this movie. And frequently we make this joke where we've actually recorded the episode and we have to pretend to have not seen the movie. But I really have not seen this movie yet, so I truly don't know. But I'm assuming no. I'm assuming it's not going to be happy and warm and fuzzy. We are going to be talking about one of JJ's favorite films, which is Steven Soderbergh's 2002 adaptation of Solaris. So we'll see.
I mean, something that we discuss in the early part of that episode, one of the few movies ever in history to receive an F cinema score.
Uh-huh. And it's a film that JJ loves dearly. And really, a film that JJ is a very, very, very intelligent man and has very, very, taste. Very good, very considered tastes. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I'm super excited. Just excited to have JJ back on the pod. Big fan of him.
Always
big great. Fan of his work. And he's always such a fun time to have. So we will see you all next week when we talk Solaris.